This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
We signed our first female talents, I think, from India and where else? Middle East, Paul?
Yes, Middle East. Jordan.
And you want to tell us those names?
Kavita Devi from India, and I cannot remember how to pronounce the one from Jordan. I'm sorry.
All right. Anyway, we'll take a guess at that. But anyway, that's created a lot of...
Hello, everybody, and welcome to an edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I am your co-host, Chris Harrington, joined with Brandon Howard Thurston. Brandon and I are trying this live stream for the first time, and we're here to talk about WWE Q3 results. We have already written an article about it, if you are Brandon Howard Thurston. We've already listened to a conference call and live tweeted it, if you're Christopher Mukigana Harrington. And we have already slept on a couch for about 6 hours, if you're my poodle Scarlet. So it's been a pretty exciting morning for us all. Brandon, how did you enjoy today's WWE Q3 Mania?
I enjoyed it. I was very excited. We learned that WWE is predicting they're going to make even more money than they thought, right? They're predicting an OIBDA of, what was it? They're predicting $108 to $112 million in OIBDA for the entire year of 2017.
Yeah, and just to touch on that, OIBDA, of course, operating income before depreciation and amortization. And the OIBDA number, sometimes, because it's their adjusted OIBDA number, they sometimes do exclude certain one-time-only costs and events. So that's not to say that they're really going to make necessarily $108 million pure profit, but if they take out things like the money they spend for the building that they're investing in, stuff like that, then they think they're going to make $100 million, which is a significant number. And I was having some doubts about whether they were going to hit $100 million, let alone go up to $108.
And for 2008, so that would be a record just in 2007, that 108 to 112 million. That would be a record for WWE in terms of, at least in terms of OIBDA, right? There's various ways to measure profit. But in terms of the OIBDA measurement, that would be a record for WWE for a year. And they're predicting in 2018, they're going to break that record again and make 115 million, at least 115 million.
Yeah, so they're, you know, some of that you could say, hey, if you can do 100 million this year, doing 115 million next year would not be very difficult because of the escalation in the TV rights fees, because they have a minimum $20 or $30 million built into those escalators. I'd have to review the old documents to be positive how much, but that's not a challenge. But it also implies that basically they have to keep their spending in check, very similar year over year, or they have to find other cost cutting measures so that they can be as profitable. But yeah, it's a, you know, the market loved it. You know, they went up by almost 10% on their stock price today. So it was clearly well received, even though they actually came in a little light on their prediction for network subs. If you were to, you know, kind of hold them to their exact number, which they had said 1.54 million plus or minus 2%, they came in at 1.52. So again, the low end.
I think the low end of that range is like 1.51. So
just barely
projected.
Yeah. And that's been kind of par for course. You know, they're about 1.2% off, but that's how they've been lately, is that they've come in a little bit below on the bottom end of each of their sub numbers for the last three or four quarters. But typically, as long as they don't miss that number by a lot, the market's okay with that, especially if they're focused more on revenue, which is a better thing, or profit, which is a better thing to focus on.
Yeah. And as of right now, the WWE stock is up almost 11%, 10.8% right now. It's up to almost $24 per share.
So let's look here, since we got the live video, instead of us being in tiny little corners here, let's look at what we've learned. KPI slides.
Yeah, so this is the first page has TV ratings. And Raw is down by just 1%. And usually this Raw comparison that they make from the previous quarter of the same year, Raw's been down, I think, in double digits. We could dig it up, but it's usually down like 8, 10, 12%, I think, even. And it's been stabilizing lately, right? And SmackDown is usually up from the same quarter in the prior year, just because with the brand split that's really helped WWE do better ratings for SmackDown. But now it looks like it's about flat year over year.
I think this would surprise a lot of WWE fans who have been told for ages here that WWE is in free fall when it comes to ratings. And here what we're seeing instead is in Q3, they basically were flat. They're slightly down, 1% drop. And USA, on the other hand, is gaining traction with that 7% gain. But you could make a strong argument that 7% gain is, that look at the difference between what even SmackDown does versus all the rest of USA Network programming. Chris Lee Knows Best is not carrying this network to its strength. Wrestling is helping a lot.
Right. But when I look separately at USA's ratings, it's mostly scripted programming, right? Especially what's in prime time. A lot of their programs year over year have a lot of decline, a sharper decline than Raw or SmackDown do. So it's always a mystery to me, like what is made up of this calculation that the USA Network is up by 7% year over year.
Well, it could be a lot of daytime programming too, just the reruns that they're showing. That maybe Law and Order or CSI or whatever it is their core daytime programming now is doing a lot better than their original scripted programming. The other part of this that, I think is interesting is we should also mention that there's two numbers on each of these pages, right? There's both the national rating and the coverage rating. USA Network has dropped about 1 million homes year over year. They went from 93 million availability to 92 million. And also see that the drop on the coverage rating is actually less than the drop on the national rating for both Raw and SmackDown, which makes some sense, especially when you consider they lost, 1 million homes.
And you want to look at it real quick? Like the so this is from TVSeriesFinale.com. This is as of October. So that's October 19th. And this looks at viewership for, this sounds like a bunch of USA primetime shows, right? And you can see the year over year is down 10%, down 1.5%, down 27%, and so on. I mean, these are declines that are bigger than the declines we see for Raw and SmackDown.
So actually that's a really interesting list too when you start looking at it and thinking about it. So you have Mr. Robot, which has been really critically acclaimed, but it does show that it has a very small demo, even though it's been very popular. Queen of the South, which was an interesting one, where that was kind of their take on a narco drama, almost playing off of the telenovela type shows that are really popular. Suits is coming back, it's their last season, I think, for them. It's a lawyer, white collar show, a little bit more in line with some of the other stuff they've done. Sinner was a big kind of drama play for them and had some big names in there being cast. And so I think that's one of the big things there. And then Shooter actually is the one that probably surprises me the most to see how much above it is, even over Falling Water, Playing House, comedy and a sci-fi series. It says a lot that, like you said, there's not a lot of strong shows there. And so wrestling is a big part of it. And so it's surprising to see that if they're all going down, how is USA improving their numbers? And I have to think it's all coming from just the reruns and the Chris Lee Knows Best and those sort of things.
Right. So going back to the KPIs.
Yes. So that's our thoughts there on the numbers that WWE can still make the claim that they like to make, which is against top 25 cable networks. They're actually losing share slower. And there was some comparisons brought up in the NFL ratings decline, which, as you'll notice here, they do not compare themselves to the NFL in any way or other sports leagues. And that almost came up actually in the Linda McMahon quote. Did you see the one I tweeted out?
No. From recently?
Linda, yeah.
Or is today, an old quote?
Yeah, right before we started the call here, Linda did a interview with is mcall.com, which is the morning call, and it's entitled Linda McMahon: How Lessons from a Wrestling Empire Can Help the Nation's Small Businesses. And the very last question on it is, what's your favorite sport? Is it professional wrestling? And any guesses to how Linda answered that question?
Sports entertainment.
She said, well, professional wrestling is an entertainment product. For pure sport as a spectator, I like the pace of basketball. Hmm. So, yes, she refused to acknowledge that wrestling could be related to sports in any way. And I think you could hear the disdain dripping from her tongue as she kind of spouted that one. But, yes, so that was a fun little thing. You can find that on my Twitter. I tweeted that a little bit ago. But let's go to the next page of the KPIs here.
Okay, we got AVOD.
Yeah, talk to people. What does AVOD stand for and why is this relevant?
So AVOD stands for advertising supported, right? Ad supported video on demand. And in this slide, so by the way, we're looking at the KPIs, the key performance indicators, and it's usually the same stuff every quarter. It's just updated, right? So in this slide, they always show us global hours viewed. This is in hours in terms of millions. And then the global views. So this is the time that people are actually taking to watch WB videos on YouTube and possibly on W.com and Facebook. And this is the number of views in terms of the individual videos that are watched. But this is a metric that we've seen have mostly explosive growth, except for in 2016, it actually went down, but it's coming back up again in 2017. And the same thing for views.
And this is really important for them in a couple ways. Number one, George Berrios used this argument when people basically said to him, "Hey, George, we don't know how to value these new TV deals coming up. We don't know what to compare you with. You know, can we really look at Major League Soccer and say whether they double their TV rights? Is that going to have an impact on you? Does, you know, the success of Young Sheldon, does that impact how your ratings are going to do?" Like they're really frustrated that they can't find a comparable thing. What should we look at? And so George said, "Well, time is your greatest asset. And we are monopolizing more and more hours of people's time."
He's been listening to WrestleMonics.
Yeah. So I think his argument there would be that 144 to 154 to 167 on millions of global hours viewed, that is a way of saying basically that, you know, AVOD has gone way up and therefore people are investing in us. And therefore, you know, that's why we're going to be a valuable product for everybody as we, as he likes to say, harness the eyeballs. And eventually, if they decided to, you know, try to do a more advertiser supported network tier, you could see this being really important for them, basically for them selling the number of hours that they have people watching things. Right now, this is mostly YouTube hours, I assume, in terms of since it's AVOD. And I guess they could call it...
I think Facebook is growing too. Like I remember the Samoa Joe and Brock Lesnar video that did really well. And mm-hmm. I remember looking into that and saying, oh, it did X number of million views on YouTube, but it also did a few million on Facebook as well. So I think the Facebook video viewership is getting comparable to YouTube.
And it does actually mention that it's anything on the WWE platform, which includes WWE.com and the WWE app. So I assume that's, you know, the kind of network interface, but that old clunky WWE app that a lot of us still have on our phone or on our tablet to watch the WWE network.
Well, the only WWE app now is the WWE network, right?
Like, well, no, I think it's still called the WWE app. And then there is a, you know, push this button to watch the network, but then you can also get like, you know, superstar stories and videos and, you know, can't, you know, access to this photo gallery, stuff like that. I think that's in there. I would have to check. And I want to give a shout out right now. It looks like we have some people listening and participating in watching this live stream. So we want to thank people. We have a little Q&A section. I have no idea if they can actually do this Q&A or not, but
we have a chat section. They can say anything in the chat. Like we have someone who's washing dishes and listening right now.
Oh, really?
And someone else is saying, yeah, if you click on the YouTube link that we put out.
Oh, I have to pull up the YouTube link and then what, mute it?
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Okay.
And we're not seeing ourselves at all unless I, as the director, make us see ourselves. So all we're seeing right now is the slide. But I can click on you and make everybody see you or me.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, there we go. Now I see it. Oh, yeah. Cool. I see the live chat as well. I hope. Yes. I paused it. Yes. Someone else. Yes. Oh, my friend Rich. Hey, big shout out to my buddy in California. We are now crossing both coasts here. So we got a guy in California, a guy in New York, and of course the most important state, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. All right, back to the show. I don't ever have a lot to say about this slide because it's one of those slides where they've figured out a way to show some fancy graphs that go up and up and make media analysts happy, but don't really correlate necessarily to any one metric that I've ever seen WWE do. I guess that would be a test for me sometime. Is to take all the metrics here and see what the R squared is against revenue or some profit or some other number. See if there's any kind of a one-to-one correlation.
I don't know. I mean, this is the one slide that you can apply a lot of cynicism to. And Vince McMahon kind of puts this information over. And then
does he though?
Too, a little bit.
He sounded so sarcastic today. It was so hard to tell. I thought his tone at one point, he goes, "And the most important metric of all, as we always say, this AVOD," and it was like, it was one of those where you really couldn't tell by his tone own, whether or not it was like legitimate. Are you waiting for me to speak?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, good. Yes, my computer, I think, got overloaded by the excitement of someone in Czechoslovakia also washing dishes. Let's go to the next slide. Sorry, and just doing this now, I'm having the realization this is not going to be a great audio podcast.
That's possible, yeah. But just do what we do. We'll figure it out later.
Yeah. Social media. What can you tell me about this slide?
Social media goes up and up every quarter.
I actually have something to say on this slide for once. Look at
The thing about social media is that you're basically always going to have gains, you know, over time, because the nature of social media is it's a new form of media and new accounts are being created all the time. And people in general are following at a faster rate than they are unfollowing. So of course this is going to increase over time.
I've always wondered.
The thing to look at is more like social media engagement, right? I think that's at least a better metric to look at, because this tells us, as they explain in these little footnotes here, these are the number of likes, follows, shares, mentions, retweets across Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and Tumblr. So at least there's this. This tells us how much people are really engaging WWE social media.
And that's a good point. So whether you're listening in the Czech Republic or in Slovakia, which are two separate countries, as I've well been reminded, I had a friend who was from Slovakia actually in high school came over. The one thing that I thought was interesting, if you notice where the growth came from this time, of their growth from 800 to 825, 12 came from that other category. So almost half of their growth came from the non-Twitter, non-Facebook category, which I just thought that was kind of interesting that we're seeing that represent the engine of growth in some ways for what's happening here. The other thing I've always wondered about is...
I think does that mean Instagram probably taking up the largest share of that? They explain that this is Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and Tumblr. I don't know that Tumblr is a really strong and growing social media platform, as much as we know that Instagram has overtaken Twitter by a wide margin.
True.
It's like monthly active users.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's true. So you're probably right. It probably is coming from a lot of Instagram. And then I always wonder with this, whether they're aggregating all of their superstar accounts.
They are.
And then
I've asked them about that. They are.
So then my question is, do they deactivate them when the person leaves?
So yeah, I wondered about that too.
So like a CJ Parker's account, you know, now that he's Juice Robinson over in New Japan, is that still counting towards WWE's numbers?
Yeah, who knows? I guess like most of the people that they release aren't their biggest stars, so they're not the ones with the biggest followings, right? And we know that WWE talent, as far as the number of people they have signed, has increased over time, right? Like they have more and more people under contract. So, you know, there's that too.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me also to see that social media engagement actually went down this quarter. Again, you'd expect it to be somewhat correlated to the biggest event. So WrestleMania time usually being the peak. And then, of course, WrestleMania is right at the very start of Q2. So it makes some sense to me that Q1's so heavy just because you have so much growth between Royal Rumble to WrestleMania.
Yeah,
but,
and even attendance, as you've pointed out, January to March, that's Q1. January to March, attendance is good. I think that's probably the strongest time for TV ratings as well.
But at the same time, look, you know, it's totally different trend than years past. 2015, it was flat for three quarters. 2016, it increased for three quarters. 2017, it's decreased for three quarters. So it is kind of funny to me that this engagement number
from one to two.
Yeah, but I mean, it was flat from Q2 through Q4. So it's just funny to me that it's all over the place. And it's a great example to me of the story changing depending on the numbers rather than having the story and then actually expecting the numbers to reflect it. Like, I always feel like they're just telling us afterwards some justification for why whatever happened was okay, rather than actually promising me ahead of time how it was going to go.
Yeah.
That's me.
Just come up with some story after the fact that makes the company sound strongest and most effective. Like we intended. Like you're saying, like Stephanie McMahon was telling some story about, what was it again?
I have no recollection.
I can't remember. Anyway.
Yeah. You can see what happens when we work without a script here and we just try to actually talk to each other. It's a lot harder.
The WWE Network.
This rainbow, this eyesore chart here. which is actually full of really interesting numbers. If you take this page and the next page and you combine them into an Excel sheet, you can get all sorts of great numbers, like the number of free international trials and average versus real. But it's so hard to look at this sheet. And, you know,
and I think that's sort of intentional, isn't it? Like they want you to look at, and I think that is the right way to look at it. You should be looking at this kind of year over year. So they want you to look at it. They want you to compare 2015, not to 2016. They want you to compare. They don't want you to compare this quarter to last quarter.
They don't want to do quarter over quarter.
This quarter, year over year, to the same quarter in the previous year. Yeah.
Do we want to look at ending
periods subs first, or do we want to look at?
Let me just kind of read off the numbers here. So here's what happened for the quarter. Q2 end, which was June 30th, we had 1.568 million people, which is 1.158 million North America and 410,000 international and about 65,000 people free. In Q3, so September 30th, we had 1.507 million people. So we lost approximately 61,000 subscribers during that time. That we had 1.106 million North America and 401,000 international and 71,000 free. So those numbers, again, we basically lost 151,000 North American. I'm sorry. We lost 52,000 North American subscribers. We lost about 9,000 international subscribers, and we gained about 6,000 free subscribers. That's the 3-month to 3-month period. If you look at the averages, Q2 averaged 1.634 million, and now it's down to 1.522 million. And again, you went from about 1.2 million North American to about 1.1 North American. And then your international number went from 422,000 to 403,000. What does that all mean? Well, stable, right? We're sitting at that 1.5 million number. And I think that's where they're going to sit for a long time here. The challenge is going to be, what are they ever going to do to get above 1.7, 1.8, let alone 2 million? That is going to be really hard. For them, the way things are structured today, I really only see them getting to a different number if you actually change the pricing on the network, or you create tiering, or something else. And at that point, what does it mean to be at 2 million? Because you're not really comparing apples to apples anymore, because a $15 network, you need less subscribers to get the same money you would have got with 2 million. Maybe having 2 million people is really important to them. But the reality is they need a new model to get there, in my mind, unless they're willing to wait 15 years for India and China to finally hit expectations.
Right. Well, George Barrios even mentioned the 3 million subscriber goal again today on the call. So it's interesting that they're not backing down from that. They're not trying to sweep it under the rug. They're still talking about it like it's a real goal.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how they're going to get there. I think, like we've discussed probably before, I think the way they can get to similar profit goals as 3 million subscribers if they tier the network and offer higher price points.
Yeah, and to be really fair, what happened is Laura Martin brought up the whole fact that at some point they had made reference to getting 2 or 3 million, she said, subscribers outside of the US, international subscribers. Yeah. And then, you could see George kind of trying to pivot a little bit on what he was saying. And he used basically the Netflix excuse, which is his new story, which is Netflix promised to get to 60 to million, 90 million people. They're about 70% of the way to their target. It's been, 8 years? And we said we would get to 3 to 4 million. We're about 50% to our target, and we did in 3 years. And so he did imply that he was going to – that 3 million, the low end, was where he was shooting for, and that they were 50% of the way there, which to some degree is true. That I think all things being perfect, yeah, they could probably hit 3 million, but I don't think they can hit it today with the service, with the offerings, with the tiering, with the rollout. I think they would have to adjust the price of the network, go to a higher tier and a lower tier, a free tier. I think they would have to kind of follow Netflix lead and do kind of a domestic price increase. I think at the same time, they should give up on the same price worldwide. So I think $9.99 is the wrong price in many of these marketplaces. So yeah. India should not be charged $9.99 in USD. That is ridiculous price for an Indian marketplace. So there's opportunities there for them to play with it.
When they launched it in China, which is something else they talked about in this release, but when they launched the W network in China, I remember I looked around at what all the other price points were, and And it, remember, it turns out that there's actually a number of different price points already. I know I can't remember what they are off the top of my head, but you know, in the UK they're paying a different price. In Ireland,
UK is
in,
yeah, UK is $9.99.
In Canada, they're paying a different price.
In
so that's
Ireland,
like,
yeah,
that's what, three or four out of their top five markets there that are not paying $9.99.
Yep, exactly. Nope, good point. I can see some awesome chat on the live stream here where people are saying, you know, that they're looking for some other services that have this data, and some people look like they might have found some links for that. And you can always tweet the link to a Brandon, and Brandon could bring it up on the screen if it's something worth looking at here.
I could.
So I will encourage you to
tweet it to me. I will try to pay attention to my Twitter here. There are many things going on all at once for me, but yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we joke about them hitting 2 million, but the reality is they've gotten close to 2 million, but an eighth of it or whatever has been free. So, you know, you can see that WrestleMania number in the corner there. They did 1.9 million total people, but that involved 288,000 free. And this is my big bone of contention, which is that WWE has not really followed through on their implied promise a couple quarters ago that they would give us some statistics and metrics around the success of the free WrestleMania model to say, here's how many people we were actually able to capture and turn into long-term subscribers and all sorts of other things. Because at the time they were basically asked, hey, can you do something on this? And the answer was, give us to the end of the year to kind of, you know, follow the experiment. And then by the end of the year, they kind of said, we don't like to go into granularity. We don't like to talk about that stuff. I didn't hear the word granularity today. There was a couple Barrios deflections, but sometimes I feel like we might have made him self-conscious about using that word.
Yeah, I think Barrios bingo ruined him.
Yeah, I have to believe on some level he at some point heard that we had figured out some of his favorite phrases and called him out on it.
Yeah, at some point I think he learned that there was a bingo card going around.
Another nice chart here. This one's a little bit easier to devour. On the right side, you have your average total domestic subscribers. Domestic in this case gets a little funny. I think domestic in this definition would actually be U.S.
Yeah, I believe when it comes to the network, domestic means U.S. only.
Yeah, but when they say domestic on attendance, they mean with Canada, because they're usually talking North America.
Yeah, because they usually use the term North America then.
Yeah. But so there's that 1.522 number that I mentioned for the average for the entire quarter. And you can see on the right side, the 1.119 million of actual people domestically paying. And again, we see about 75% of the WWE network is still a domestic service, which will play into something we'll see when we look at the earnings numbers, which is basically that the majority of their growth is still coming from North America, despite this huge emphasis on international and international markets. So the network today is a domestic-driven thing, and there's a lot of questions about what they could do to change that, you know, specifically around should they be using more localization, languages, international talent, should they be pricing it differently, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is this thing makes or breaks itself on whether the U.S. has a lot of people subscribing to it. Going to the next chart is my favorite one. There's the Barrios bingo here. So let's see here. Let's go back to bingo there for a second. Let's just check it out.
Sure.
I'm glad you brought that up.
I think I might have killed it. Hang on.
You might have killed it.
No, it's coming back. Wait.
Pshaw.
Oh, there's my Twitter.
Oh, wow. Look at that guy. Does not look like you.
No.
All right. So we got Timor-Leste, which was the tiny country that he used to brag about.
Timor-Leste is I don't know where that is, but
it's in East Asia, I believe.
There you go.
Social media footprint. He doesn't say footprint that much anymore. This is from
a while ago. He doesn't say much of any of these words anymore.
Yeah, tiger by the tail, no. Granularity, no. Pivot occasionally, adjusted OIBDA, yep. Clarion call, left that one out. Unpack the content, not quite. China, of course. Churn, yep. Peak profitability, no. Lumpiness, no. India's the future, sort of. Refuse to detail predict, yeah. Viewers, hours per household, not quite. Affinity households, he dropped that one. Yeah, he's really adjusted his whole playbook here.
Yeah, so I tweeted this about 2 years ago. This is for WQ3 2015.
There we go.
How about that?
All right, let's go back to the branded thing here. So yeah, the next slide, I'm always fascinated about because it has churn on there. And so what you're looking at is in that Q3 column there, the negative 453 and the positive 392. So this is implying that on a service that has about 1.5 million people, period, that subscribe to it. 453. So almost either a third or a quarter, depending on the math you want to do here, gave up on the service. And 392, again, a third, a quarter, whatever you want to use as your math, added the service for a net of 61. And this is the biggest question to me, is just trying to understand that 453. What percentage of that is just people jumping back and forth? What percentage of that is people that care so much about main events that they want to see Brock Lesnar versus Samoa Joe and they don't want to see Roman Reigns versus whomever? And then what percentage of that is just, you know, the natural cycle of people checking it out and dropping it? Because right. This
it'd be
is
interesting
paid...
to compare. It'd be interesting to compare like every account that's either active or inactive across time, right? And if especially if you could look at it like around pay-per-view dates to see if any pay-per-views increased mm-hmm. the total number of accounts that exist, because maybe theoretically you could say that that's telling you what's earning new fans, as opposed to winbacks, as they would call it, where you get, say, I cancel the WWE network for a time and then I decide, oh, I'm gonna watch it for this pay-per-view, and I come back.
Well, and the other part about this is, and this is where I don't buy the I'm just going jumping from free trial to free trial, is it does say paid additions, churn and ending subscriptions. And that would imply that these are people that are paid that are leaving, and these are people that are paid that are getting added on. And so to me, it seems like unless they're counting all the free trials as just negatives, it just doesn't make sense to me how this could just all be free trials. This really seems like this is actual paid accounts going in and going out.
Yeah, I'm sure there are people gaming the system, but I don't really believe that it's widespread. Just because it is sort of a discussion I was having about New Japan World and why it's not on these other OTT platforms and accessibility. I think we underestimate, especially when we're kind of nerds sitting here at computers and going through all this computer stuff, I think we underestimate how much friction or how little friction the average consumer will tolerate. Like the amount of friction, the amount of trouble that you have to go through to create a new account, I think it's too much for the average person to make a really significant difference to this business.
Here's the very easy number. We know at the end of September, at the end of June, there was only 60,000 to 70,000 free people. So for people to be telling me it's 100,000 or 200,000 people, there's not even 100,000 free accounts at any given time, except for at WrestleMania weekend. So most of the time there's not an ability for 100,000 people to say be doing this. Now, even if you were to say it's the same 60,000 people five times, that just doesn't make sense because there's only 3 months. So I just can't believe that all of that is driven by that. But at the same time, that's sky high, it seems like, every quarter for it to be in that $400,000 to $500,000 or people range. So it's just so weird to me. And I have talked to other analysts who have also felt that this is really weird and they can't make sense of it. And so I'm glad WWE keeps showing it. Yeah.
One of our listeners has sent us Netflix and Amazon. I want to take a look at that real quick.
Sure. Let's bring it up. Again, this is going to be a terrible audio podcast, but it's a great visual podcast. Yeah. Netflix continues to build its global audience. So this is the number of Netflix subscriptions showing the international domestic split. So, obviously the very quick takeaway here is look at how international exploded for Netflix. As they made the decision to go in. And of course, I'll also bring up the fact that they did not, in fact, go into China. They've still stayed out of China all of this time. They decided to license their content directly to Chinese media companies, but not actually to be in the player themselves. But 47% of it coming there. And this is something where I always feel like I would love to see WWE stack themselves up against some of these other countries of the world. Because we know that like the Nordic countries have a huge consumption of streaming services. We know Brazil has been really big into streaming services. We know that in places like Mexico and in Japan and whatnot, we've seen different marketplace dynamics. I'd love to see WWE really go head to head, because we see a lot of information about how Netflix and Amazon have done. Now, that said, what did they say in today's call when someone asked them about a comparison to Netflix?
They said that we're not a general media service, and you shouldn't necessarily compare us to general media services. So it's, they want to be compared to who they want to be compared to when it's convenient for them.
Yeah, George was very adamant they should not be being compared to Netflix, because Netflix is a general entertainment platform and they have a niche platform, which of course brings up everyone remembering the taglines with Michael Cole, where they called it the Netflix of, the WWE network is like Netflix, but only better, stuff like that, which,
And I think they use that phraseology to communicate to their fans that it's an OTT service without saying
yes.
OTT service, which probably sounds like jargon to a wide audience.
I don't think OTT service means anything to anyone except for nerds like us.
Yeah. You want to look at Amazon? Here's yeah. Amazon.
Oh, wow. So Amazon, global retail revenue. So Amazon, I don't know if this one tells us as much just because Amazon's decision to make Amazon Prime Video a focus for them is a relatively new thing. And also it was bundled, you know, you can see how every quarter Q4, that's, you know, for Christmas time, things go flying high.
This actually isn't about Amazon Prime, right?
This is just about Amazon period.
Amazon's retail sales.
But we don't know very much about Amazon Prime subscriptions, except for to say we can model it on how much Amazon Prime.
And Amazon, I don't know. Amazon doesn't report their Amazon Prime subscribers every quarter like WWE does. We should look into that.
Yeah, I don't know. And my friend made a good point here that every country of the world has different content for Netflix, in that Netflix does not, you know, when I go to Canada, I get so much better content. It's funny. It's like HBO in the US and Canada, Netflix are very similar, where oftentimes I can watch, you know, real-time airing of shows or the next day shows like Better Call Saul or something will be available. I know in the US they started doing that this year, but in Canada they've been doing that for years. And I would just see a lot of great movies up there, you know, all the Disney portfolio and things like that. But yep. So those are kind of good, interesting things to think about. And it also kind of reminds us that, you know, Prime subscriptions are probably going to peak, but they're for 1 year. So it's not necessarily going to have the same variability as something else. Yeah. All right. So yeah, just the huge churn numbers on this just blow my mind since it says gross additions. This is the chart I really wanted to speak to. Yeah, the attendance number. This was, again, one of those minor shockers that, you know, nobody asked a single thing about this. And there's three really interesting stories in my mind about this. And of course, what I'm talking about is the fact that in Q3, for North America, which involves just US and Canada, and the way they define it is 4,900 people per show. But they ran 89 shows this year in Q3. And that's only on WWE main roster. That doesn't even include NXT. That is an interesting number. And so I went back into the books. And for people that are Patreon supporters, you can go to the WrestleNomics folder that you have access to. And I actually pulled up all of the old KPIs to figure out when was the last time they had it this low for Q3. And what I found is in 2011 Q3, it was at 4,900. And if we go back to 2006, it was 5,500, then 5,500, 5,300, 5,800, 5,200, 4,900 in 2011, 5,200, 5,500, 5,100, 5,100, 5,300, 4,900. So we have seen this plus or minus maybe 600 people per show variability over the last, let's say 12 years. This has been the lowest number though in probably 5 years, which is significant, I think. That said, 89 shows at 4,900 people is a heck of a lot more people than even 71 shows at 5,300 people, I believe. I would have to do the math really quickly here.
Right. Like I did the math real quick when I was looking at it earlier. Like you take 5,100 in 2015, and you multiply that by 79 events, that's
403,000 approximately.
Yeah, 403,000. Then you take previous year and multiply that by 71, you've got
376. So much lower.
So and then this year, you take out the 49, multiply it by 89 events, and you're at 436.
So it's even higher than it was, yeah. 403. So yeah, so they've actually done more people. And on top of that, not only have they done more people, if you look in their the text of the earnings, they say they actually increased North American ticket prices by 5% this year.
Yeah. And we should point out, like, if we were probably going to talk about revenue and whatnot later, and the revenue includes NXT, but what we're talking about right now, these attendance numbers are only main roster, only Raw and SmackDown.
Yes. And it's intriguing to me that you know, somebody else pointed out to me that while we have heard a lot of doom and gloom about how poorly some of the TV live events have done for attendance, where, you know, we have not, you know, house buildings that only hold 6,000 not selling out for Raw, things like that, there has been probably a greater ability of them this year to use modular ticket pricing, where they've done, you know, deals where there's both, you can get a Raw and a SmackDown ticket, or you can
We heard about that tickets. In Denver, where they ran a Raw and a SmackDown in Denver on consecutive days, and there were deals where, you know, it's like a buy two and save.
Yeah, and so I think that's interesting. And as is pointed out here, they are able to get both a price increase, 5%, and a number of events, large increase. I think it says something. I mean, the fact that basically they are running SmackDown house shows on Monday nights, good evidence of saying, you know, they can still make money doing that. Now, yeah. That said...
And if you don't know, here are some of the scary pictures that have circulated on social media of arenas. This is of a Raw, apparently. You can see the Raw logos up here, and you can, if you look close, you can see quite a few empty seats. I'm not sure which event this was. This was probably sometime in September when a lot of people were taking pictures of Raw and SmackDown, particularly TV tapings, not so much house shows, but you can see, and this is probably opposite the hard cam, probably with the hard cam over here, or I'm sorry, this is probably the hard cam side. And so what they'll do is, you know, put people opposite the hard cam, so the arena looks full, but in reality there are quite a few empty seats. But yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a tale of two stories where I think they would love to be doing better. I think the fact they're only down by a few hundred people and they ran that many more events, it's not as dramatic as I might fear. And what I would actually say is, if I see three or four quarters of this, I would panic. If it's just a one quarter thing, you know, they always have the option on pulling back on the number of live events they're running. And the reality is right now they're making probably more per penny profit on this because revenue did quite well, in fact, for live events this quarter, did it not?
Yeah. And I think the larger story here is, yeah, they would love to be doing higher average attendances, but this business is becoming, and I'm talking about like WWE's business overall, is becoming just a more and more efficient machine. Attendance is becoming more and more of a volume game. More events, higher ticket prices, and maybe they'll suffer when it comes to average attendance. And even now, the thing that could raise WWE's business across the board and raise average attendances is if they, I don't know, actually created some stars, which they seem to have a lot of trouble doing. But,
yeah, so they did 31.6 million in live events for Q3 compared to 28.6 million the year before and 26.1 million the year before that. So
do we want to look at pull up training schedules for that?
Yeah, if you have it, that'd be great. That's what I'm looking at. Yeah,
can read this. If you can't read this out there, tell us. I'm going to try to zoom in though.
It's pretty good.
So we're talking about live events, the live events segment. And if you don't know, WWE breaks its business up into a number of segments, which you can see over here on the left, network, TV, and so forth. And we can look at live events, and you can see how that's been doing across the quarters here. So this is the number that they just reported today, 31.6 million, compared to other Q3s, 28.6 and 26.1. So even though average attendance is up, or average attendance is down, the revenue is up. And again, that's due to more events, higher ticket prices, SmackDown having its own brand, SmackDown being able to, you know, run on Monday, so there's more shows, and they're including NXT live event revenue in this as well.
Do you remember when they signed like a deal with, was it Ticket King or StubHub?
StubHub, they announced they have a deal to do, I think it's to be an exclusive partner, but that you can still find WWE tickets on other secondary market websites, as far as I know.
And I've never gotten a straight answer of what exactly that means. I don't know if that means they take their excess tickets and they immediately put it on for resale on the StubHub market, and then they get a kickback of, you know, what's resold, if they get a percentage of the resale on any ticket, or what it is.
Right. What we're referring to is this press release that was put out on March 28th, right before WrestleMania, where they say StubHub today announced they have reached a multi-year agreement naming StubHub the company's, that is WWE's, exclusive ticket resale marketplace for fans in the U.S. and Canada.
So it would especially be curious, you know, for next year's WrestleMania, if maybe we see a closer relationship with StubHub, where maybe for getting, you know, the big, big, big ticket prices, if there's packages or something that they're reselling using them. Yeah. Let's go back to the KPIs. For a second, but yeah, I think that was the big takeaway, is that US did pretty well all in all. The international was a little crazy because they're down, but they only ran seven events, because as you see, Q2 and Q4 are the big international quarters. That's when they go do the big European tour. Q3 of this year, I would have to actually stretch my mind a little bit to think where they went. I guess any ideas where they would have been in Q3 of this year?
For what? I'm spacing out. Sorry.
That's all right. For WWE, where they ran in Q3 this year.
Like the cities that they ran in? International? They were in South America, but I think that was after September 30th, though.
Yeah, that's why I was saying. I'm wondering now. Let me look here. I can actually look that up on using rest of the world?
Cage match.
Yeah. Went to cage match. They did an Australia tour. That was really big. Back in September.
Mm-hmm.
They did a Asia tour, I think, as well. Let me check. And they did a couple house shows, including the house show in China and the ones in Japan. Actually, one of them was on the 30th of June 30th, and one of them was on July 1st. So one in each quarter. So those were probably most of their ones. And then for Europe, let me see if they actually went to Europe at all in Q3.
Right. So you're probably looking at this. We're pulling up cage match here and just look at the rest of the world.
Yep. They did not run Europe in Q3.
Yeah, so we see Austria, New Zealand.
And then if you do the same on Asia, you'll see a couple other Tokyo and China events.
And that's actually just what's this quarter? It's just that.
Yep.
But then there's Asia, right?
Yep, because they said they ran 7, I believe, was the number. And so...
something like that. Well, anyway. Anything else we need to look at from the KPIs? Because that's the...
Is that the end of it?
That is the end.
So, this is at the very end. That's where I got that 92 million number from, is on the first footnote on the appendix.
I see. Okay. And that sounds about right compared to the stuff I've seen on certain TV ratings news websites where they periodically put out a table of how many homes each cable network is in.
Since you're doing all this live event updating, can you pull up what WWE stock price is right now? Maybe finance.google.com or something?
Yeah, let's refresh that. 10% flat at the moment as of 2:14 p.m. Eastern.
I love the facts that it gives you on the side here. We know that it's founded by Vince McMahon, and they have a ring announcer named JoJo.
Yeah, did you notice that?
Those are like the 5 most important things for you to know at this moment. So.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really flat for the last 2 days. So this is a big increase, and a lot of people have been saying, it's intriguing to see who are these people that are investing heavy in this, right now. It's almost, it's odd. Usually you try to sell right after kind of that earnings there. Now that it's been.
What we usually see on the day of quarterly reports is that the stock price more often than not goes down.
Because people sell, sell on results. Not uncommon.
So why do you think it went up today? Because they upgraded their OEBITDA projections?
A little bit. Yeah. And it'll probably go down tomorrow. I'm guessing, I think, I'll be curious to see what happens tomorrow. I always find that it takes people a day to consume WWE news, that they either are waiting for, the major funds to come out with their new recommendations or something. But a lot of times Friday, there's actually a big reaction to what's happened. More times than not, it's been a normalization, but in this case, it might be the normalization in the way they don't like so much, but yeah. So somebody asked us to answer just the basic question so that they don't have to listen to us blather all day, which is WWE business healthy? I think to answer that question, I'd like to open up the earnings report real quick.
The press release itself?
Yeah, let's open up the press release. This, yeah, this so piece. this number right there. So let's just kind of look at these numbers here. And so this is 9-month column, the one on the far right, that's the one I'd focus on. And so they're up to about $590 million for 9 months, meaning that they're going to be they're going to be well over $600 million and probably trying to break $700 million for next for the whole full year if they could. They're up by about $55 million growth. And if we were to say, where is that $55 million coming from? Well, about 14 comes from the network. About 21 comes from television. Home entertainment was down a little bit this year. Digital media was up by 3 million. And then live events was up by about 10 million. And then licensing went up by 1 million. And shop went up by about 1.5 million. And studios managed to get you about 1.5. So what is their engine of growth?
Merchandise, WWE shop and venue merchandise have been areas of business that have been steadily growing. And I guess there's probably some technology reasons for why WWE Shop has been doing better and better. They're just becoming more and more available, probably in international markets, right?
I wonder if WWE Shop includes international markets, like you're saying, that are actually not done through WWE Shop. So Amazon UK, the sold shop in India. Yeah,
I think
like
Amazon
that.
Stuff is included in this segment, right?
Yeah.
I think that's been stated in a 10Q or something like that.
What intrigues me is the fact that venue merchandise is nearly flat year over year, despite them running 89 events, so many more than they did a year ago. So in fact, you could say that venue merchandise is actually down a lot per show.
And the total number of attendees is up. So you would think more heads should equal more merchandise sales.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of a surprise for me. But partially international might be playing into that, because international, I think they disproportionately buy venue merchandise. So when you have a big drop in international fans, it might hurt you more. But the question is it healthy? Yes, it's healthy because they have two engines of growth. They have an engine of growth coming from television, and they still have an engine of growth coming from the network. Now, if you go down a little bit to the operating income, what you'll quickly realize is, my goodness, I just said that they did $100-some million in network revenue, right? $151 million, and they make $38 million OIBDA on that. That's like a 28% OIBDA percentage. So they make a 28% profit on every network. So
we're talking about operating income, though, right? Which is slightly different than OIBDA.
It is. You're right. It's a little bit. It's a little bit lower, because OIBDA is operating income, but then you back out depreciation, amortization. But they're very close to each other. It's 25%, I believe, in this number, and then it's 28% is the other number. Okay. So about 25% profit on the network segment versus $95 million of profit on the television segment. So the most important thing to me is the fact that their most profitable single segment, television rights, is growing by $21 million a year or more, and is continuing to generate big profits. And then their second largest revenue segment, which is only at half the profit of the TV one, is still growing quite a lot and is still being profitable. So they have to keep their spending in check. And you can see corporate and other continues to blossom, right? $19 million increase year over year. Now, most of that was from earlier in the year, because you can see their spend is actually equal year over year, from $47 million to $46.9 million. So they didn't really spend that much more on corporate and other than they did a year ago for the one quarter, but for the whole year, they're up by almost $20 million. So it gets complex every time they talk about it. Some of it is legal cost. Some of it is the fact that they keep growing the performance center and all those contracts go against corporate and other. Some of it is the investment that they did in the analytics team. And then some of it is the building that they bought and that they're spending money on.
Because they said the spending on the network has decreased, right? And that's why, as we see here, you know, operating income on the network is up significantly.
Yeah, it's almost dollar for dollar, right? It's up $15 million, and they're up about $15 million in revenue. So they're fixed.
Just all those expensive legal fees that they're incurring from various lawsuits.
The 10Q actually does break down what is the spend on legal fees. And so they actually do talk about that. And it is up by several million for this year, but we're not talking 10 or 20 million. It's up by like 3 to 5 million, I think. Speaking of which, there was a ruling in the CM Punk subpoena lawsuit where, Punk had been asked to pay $120,000, which was half of the $240,000 for his subpoena. And the judge basically ruled that he should pay $40,000, which is very close to the like $39,000 that he had proposed he would pay. So that was interesting to me that the judge just basically said $40,000, we're done. And I'll be curious to see if WWE appeals it or not. But in theory, that would mean WWE would have to eat the cost of about $200,000 of legal expenses just for that one thing with CM Punk in Connecticut. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know whether, you know, they'll work out a different deal with their lawyers for what they're really paying. But that's a good example of a single lawsuit costing them $200,000. And that was just for a subpoena to CM Punk about his Illinois action. So it intriguing to me. Is WWE healthy? My answer, yes. They're healthy because they have these TV rights fees that are guaranteed. And that was something that came up in the investment slides, is basically, when do you have to renegotiate? And that's going to change their entire deal. They're healthy as long as they have a good relationship with NBCU. And this is my new core thesis. WWE cares a lot more about their relationship with NBCU than they care about with their core fans. Because that's the thing that's going to get them through the next 10 years in a way that, there were zero questions about Roman Reigns getting the mumps or about Jinder Mahal being your Indian champion.
Or about Neville walking out or something.
Neville walking out. Brock Lesnar becoming a free agent in the next 12 months. John Cena leaving to do movies. The aging talent base. Kurt Angle being called back and medical drama. None of that. Not a single one of those things was talked about. Instead, what they talked about.
To be clear, for people who aren't familiar with this, the people who ask the questions. So when they do this conference call, they go through a PowerPoint presentation and then they open up the phone so that analysts who represent various investment firms can ask questions. And these aren't necessarily people who are following the product or, you know, who are browsing wrestling Twitter. These are kind of, you know, media savvy people who also cover other media companies, right? And WWE is a turn on for them because it's this. They came out with this OTT streaming service, so it's a lot of that. It's not necessarily people who are watching the product from week to week.
No. It's, I mean, there's a few, and you do sense that there's guys like a Mike Hickey will talk about, hey, you had a good show last night. I enjoyed this. Yeah. Or my kid did this. So I mean, and I've talked to Brandon Ross, and same deal. He will, you know, infer that he was at WrestleMania or he talked to them. Yeah. But,
There are people who ask questions. Like, we had questions today about, I think, women's wrestling, and there was some talk about the Mae Young Classic. So there is some awareness of, like, what the current product is doing, but it's definitely not anything that comes from a fan perspective.
And nor is it necessarily relevant always. Like, I think there's this desire to correlate championship reigns with financial performance. And, you know, that's why I go back to my thing about, you know, the WWE CFO who successfully gets the WWE Network launch and proves the pay-per-view model, all those kind of people, they deserve as much credit for helping the wrestling business as a lot of other people out there. But you're never going to want to talk about how exciting that is, because it's a business-oriented decision-making that, you know, is not really that sexy the way other stuff is.
Yeah, and like that's something that I've like come to realize as I've studied this stuff more and covered these more over the last couple of years, is you come in with the mentality of a wrestling fan, and you want to look at the wrestling metrics, which is still the thing that I look at the most, but you kind of like, you're expecting to get answers, who's a draw or who's not, or what's failing and what's succeeding, and it's really a lot more complex than that. And
but I will say, at 4,900 people a show, if they had a super hot champion, I think it would be hotter.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's like kind of exactly the point that I want to get to, is that I think the big story underneath that nobody talks about and nobody can really deal with except for Vince McMahon is that, you know, this company could be booked a lot better and they could cultivate stars a lot better, but they don't. And I don't know how much of a difference that makes to WWE's business. I don't know if that means they could be in a boom period right now, but they're not. But I think they do leave money on the table because of the way that the product is presented.
And this is something I was mentioning on Twitter today, which is, I think the complacency breeds a contempt for riskiness that sometimes generates really interesting returns. And what I mean by that is, the reason WWE UK languishes is because WWE is doing just fine economically. And so there's no need to kind of sign these things and do something with them, as much as you can sign them and then just lord it over some other TV company or some talent group and say, you can't do this now because I have the rights to these people. And if they were in financial peril, you would see them either give up on these ideas or maybe even double down or just see that going in. And so we are seeing elements of strategy play out. And it's funny, like I said, I couldn't tell if Vince McMahon was serious or sarcastic when he talked about social media there. And in the sense that every year they come up with their talking points. And clearly this year's talking point is the women's revolution. That's, you know, people fed them lines. They talked about it. They made it a big deal. But
they mentioned that the Mae Young, I think this is Michelle Wilson, answered this question. She said that the Mae Young Classic viewership was on par, I believe that was the phrase, on par with the men's tournaments that they've done, which she seemed to be referring to the Cruiserweight Classic and the UK tournament.
Yeah, and I wish they had gone a little bit more in depth about that, because, you know, I think there's a great question, even for people that barely watch wrestling, to ask, which is, hey, you rolled out a binge model similar to Netflix rather than your week-to-week model. What did you learn from that? What are you going to do differently? What was the findings on that? And, you know, even Paul Levesque was in the room. We know that because Vince McMahon was decided to, I mean, he didn't decide to bring up, it was on the slide that he was going to bring up these Middle Eastern and Indian signees for women that they did. And then, then for whatever reason, he decided he would try to say their names. And then he's like, I don't know their names. Paul, what's their names? And Paul remembered Kavita Devi, but he did not remember anyone else's. He did not remember the name of the woman from Jordan. So that was a rather hilarious little clip where we learned, A, Paul Levesque was in the room, something we did not know previously. And I can see myself on your super screen here. I don't know if you noticed that.
What am I doing? It's Kavita Devi. So he brought up that they signed two new talents, one from India and one from – he wasn't really sure. And then Paul Levesque had to interject Jordan. So it's Kavita Devi. Paul Levesque had to remind him, and – Paul Levesque didn't even try to pronounce. Let's see. Shadia B-S-E-I-S-O.
Basario or something?
I'm not sure. Shadia.
Yeah, from Jordan. And she's I know she's done some MMA training and things. I've heard from people saying that, you know, they saw her at a camp in the UK or other places in the past. But it was just funny with them coming up that, again, it was Women's Revolution is this like big tagline for them this year. And I think it's an interesting investment from them, though I would question whether or not it's having a substantial financial impact on them. I would love actually if they broke it out, you know, say, hey, our licensing on the female superstars this year, we were able to do 25% more, or, you know, the royalty checks we paid out were this much higher. We're the whatever. They mentioned that 35% of their roster was female, a number that Michelle Wilson had at her fingertips. And Michelle Wilson, someone who hasn't been on these calls in recent months. So it was interesting to see her kind of being brought in and almost forcefully be part of this conversation, where it's clear that they kind of, this seems to be part of her marketing initiative for the years, talking about the women's revolution.
Yeah, this year, I think, at least since WrestleMania, Michelle Wilson's been on the calls. And I wonder, like, just seeing, you know, having it revealed that Paul Levesque is in the room, I wonder how many people are in that room.
You know, well, like, the funniest was when Laura asked to talk to Vince, as she always does. And then George Berrios answered the whole question. And part of me thought, oh my God, did Vince get up and leave? Like, did he just, did he decide he wanted to go to the bathroom or go get a drink or have a steak wrap what it was going to be? But no, then at the end, Vince kind of chimed in. But we would love to see the WWE Network video of these calls.
That's right.
Years and years ago, I was at a corporate event for a different company I worked for, and there was the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company, one of the largest companies in the world, came in to visit us, and it was fascinating because he had all these hand signals. So we had all these we had pre-planned questions. So like they'd be like, who here is going to ask about this? And then you would raise, you know, you'd figure it out, and then you'd stand up in the room and say, I know that you've done a great investment in this sort of thing. What are your thoughts on this? And they would answer the question that they had pre-planned. Wow. But then like when they did kind of actual Q&A, the CEO had like secret hand gestures where he would be like, you know, kind of put his hand down or hand up or like put his, you know, kind of touch his watch. And that would be the indicator to the CFO of basically you're going to answer this or I'm going to answer this. And it was kind of like, if it's a real question, you answer this. If it's a fluff question, I answer it. So it was just interesting. And I just imagine we'd see those same kind of, you know, nonverbal cues going on in that WWE room there where, you know, Vince McMahon sees Laura and then the eyes get big and then he just looks at George. And then I don't even think he points. I think Vince McMahon.
Or maybe he wanted to go put ketchup on his steak wrap or something.
Yeah, I would love to see that. And yes, that's a great question. Who's in that room at that time? You know, is local corporate counsel there? Is Laura sitting in the room or someone else?
Is Stephanie in the room? Is Jerry McDevitt?
Amon, is he? I doubt Jerry's in the room. Jerry's in Pennsylvania. I think that's the thing that we always forget.
So Jerry doesn't work at in Stanford.
No, he works for K&L Gates. He's a private lawyer. He just happens to be WWE's primary lawyer.
Right, right.
And so like for instance, I was reading the sanctions thing against Kairos. And I found the transcript of the January meeting they did where they were scheduling. And Jerry was like, we will drive up the day before this thing. We'll spend the night and then we'll be here all day to do court. And so I imagine Jerry has to come up a lot for all these cases. But no, he definitely doesn't live in Connecticut, or at least he doesn't work out of Connecticut. He works out of Pennsylvania, as far as I can tell.
Okay.
Scroll down just a little bit on this key earnings page. I just want to make my other thesis one more time. Fascinating to me. Net revenues by region. North America, 446 out of 584 or 589. And last year it was 398 out of 534. If we look at the growth for the year, it's about $55 million. If we look at the growth in North America for the year, it's about $48 million. 48 over 55 is about 88%. I didn't do those in my head. I knew that from earlier. But the point here is 90% of their growth comes from North America. And I don't think that's the story they tell. They tell you that it's coming from international and this and this and this and this. But 90% of their growth came from North America this year. And sometimes I feel like they're underserving their North American marketplace compared on how much effort they're putting towards other things. On the flip side, if you listen to Laura Martin, her question was, why did it take you guys 15 years to realize international is the future? And do you want to give your take on that before I give my long-winded take on it?
Well, the first question that comes to mind is like, well, how would, if you think they could do more effort in North America, like what would that be? Laura Martin asked about how, and this is the question that Berrios answered for Vince, but she asked, you know, why are we signing all these international talents now? And why didn't we do this 15 years ago? I know Berrios tried to answer with something about how, because of the network? Is it just because, you know, stuff with technology and because of the media environment that we're able to market better to these international markets? Because she said, I thought there was a strong wrestling market in lots of other countries.
Yeah. So her point was that, and then George went back to his old answer of basically, why are we doing the network instead of a pay-per-view model? Which was before there was limited content providers and limited ways for us to, quote, get a video into the pipe. And now any broadband home can connect to us and we can monetize that. And that's much more valuable to us than, say, making a deal with an international TV provider and then only having them as our option for pay-per-views and whatnot. Right. Now, my real theory on this is George Berrios and Michelle Wilson both came on board in the mid-2000s. I think it was like 2007, 2008, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And that means their history goes back to that year. And prior to that, they have not as much institutional knowledge about what was happening and why it was happening. And I think it's a fallacy for them to pretend that WWE has not been fascinated by international markets for years and years and years, because that completely ignores the boom from the mid-2000s that was happening in Europe. I still have you, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. You were so motionless that I began to think you froze for a second there. But I think it ignores that entire boom period where, you know, Italy and things like that were exploding, or the UK was really hot. And WWE has been in international markets for 25 plus years. If you look at the relationship with Sky in the UK, it's, you know, it goes back 25 plus years. They've been touring all over the world. You know, in the 80s, they went all over the place. In the 90s, they did, until the wrestling kind of fell down. And so part of it is that they are underplaying the contributions from their former international heads. So be it Garrett Meyer before them, or years and years before that, there's been many other heads of international that worked for them. And I think they're really underplaying the contributions that those people did to their international marketplaces. There was a little bit more of, I think, a system where international market growth was maybe not so centralized, where it kind of went more to a single person rather than kind of flowing all the way up to the top the way it does now. And, you know, what Ed Wells is doing today in international, you know, you'll see his name a lot, where he's like a VP that they came up through Japan and now is doing a lot of things around the world, setting up these marketplaces. But they've gone into Mexico and they've left Mexico. They've gone into Brazil and they've left Brazil. They've gone into India. They've gone into China. They've gone into Japan. They've started offices in the UK and lots of places all these years. And sometimes they've stuck and sometimes they haven't. And of course, they quietly don't announce when they kind of go away from things, and they only announce when they go into them. But it's been a different model. And the other part is it was advertising. They did a lot of local advertising model where they would try to get a lot more revenue.
Do world economies have a lot to do with this, though? Are we, like, in the last few years, are we, you know, approaching a time where these other markets in Asia, or in maybe even Europe or in Latin America, have these economies gotten that much stronger that it's more worth their while to market to them?
Certain markets. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more money in media for Russia and India than there ever was.
Like, has India's economy really strengthened a lot in the last 5 to 10 years?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, the media rights money that they're kicking out. I mean, all you have to do is look at what the media writes that the U.S. was kicking out 15 years ago, and then imagine that most other countries of the world were lower than that, and how much that's exploded. So there's certainly a lot more there. But I think from a live event potential standpoint, they've underutilized it. And if you go back, Shane McMahon had a plan in 2006, I think it was, to do international territories and international marketplaces. And they kind of stymied their own growth there. And I would argue that they have thought about international for years and years and years. And it's a complete fallacy to pretend like they just discovered it now. They totally underpenetrate the Latin American marketplace. We know, you know, from CMLL and AAA and the crash and everything else, just what a rich country Mexico could be for wrestling. Is that right for WWE's model? I don't know. But it's a rich country with a wrestling tradition, for sure. And they definitely underpenetrate that, which is why it's good that they're doing more localization models where they're getting the language right. I thought it was fascinating what they talked about. What would the world look like in 2 years and 10 years? What would the network look like in 2 years? And what would the world look like in 10 years? Do you want to share those comments from Berrios?
If I have them here. I know he talked about talent development. He said, if you look out, you know, 10 years from now, WWE will probably, you know, it'll go from being in Orlando to being in a number of countries throughout the world.
And yeah, I would love to see Paul's face on that one too.
Yeah. And someone asked him about the WWE network, and he basically predicted that, you know, if you look out within 2 years, the WWE network will probably be in another language. And I believe he made another point that I don't have on hand, though.
Yeah, he just said it will have multiple tiers and be in at least another additional language.
Yeah, multiple pricing tiers, right.
Yeah.
When do you think we're going to see multiple pricing tiers on the network? Do you think it's going to happen in 2018?
It's a great question. My gut is that WWE Network subscriber growth is going to stagnate a little bit over the next year here. It's going to be tough to keep adding more than, you know, 50,000 to 100,000 people. And that only leaves them a few options. I think the most likely one is that you increase the price of the network around the time of WrestleMania and somehow try to make that, you know, like a big tiered option time. And so around the time of WrestleMania, Royal Rumble 2018, that's a great time to do it. At the same time, you know, they just made those lofty promises for OIBDA goals for next year. And that's a lot of variability to put into the system to try to hold your OIBDA straight, because you could see, you know, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 people coming or going in a direction. So you have to create a lot of protections around yourself if you're going to do that kind of a big bang. And until they have these TV deals done, I don't know if they have the appetite to do the big bang. And now that hearing their timing on their TV deals, it makes me wary that they would actually introduce it in 2018. So yesterday I would have said, you know, April of 2018, maybe. Now that we saw the slide that you're about to bring up, I'm less focused on them actually hitting tiers next year, unless they decide to maybe just do a basic price increase by talking about, you know, Netflix changed it and we're going to change it for new subscribers. And then at the same time, they might adjust some worldwide market pricing.
Yeah.
I mean, so to me, look at this. India is changing in 2019. Doesn't that suggest that maybe if you're worried about screwing with India, you don't screw with it until 2019?
Yeah. So we saw from this is a slide from their investor presentation that and this is really kind of the biggest story that there is for WWE, right? Because this is talking about TV rights renegotiations, and TV revenue is the biggest source of revenue for WWE. It's about a third of their revenue. The US deal with NBC Universal is the biggest deal. And they're saying that the negotiations for that, or at least they want to announce their future distribution plan somewhere between May and September of 2018. So that's coming up pretty soon.
Yeah. And this is intriguing because this is what burned them. So in 2014, when they were announcing the new deal, they kind of said we would get it done by the end of 2013. And then it was the beginning of 2014. And then it was the middle of 2014. It wasn't until May of 2014 that they actually announced the deal, if I recall correctly. And that
about
was
May, and that's when the stock price
plummeted, because they only got about
burst on the stock price.
Yeah, because they only got about 1.5 times the increase of what they said they would get, or they only got 1.5 times their current rate versus the 2x to 3x to 4x that others had proposed for them.
Right, and Vince McMahon admitted himself, I think, in Variety, that the reason why the TV rights deal was not as good as they expected was because of the timing of it. So this looks like this dropped hard.
Well, what happened was in March, all these rumors flew. So that $30 number was like for a day. And it was in March, all these rumors flew. And then in May is actually when they did.
I remember that the W Network launches right about here.
Yep.
March 28th, I think, is the day. So around here, the W Network launches.
Yep. So, and then the stock explodes and there's a little bit of rumors there. Then after WrestleMania, they don't hit a million. And so it falls. And then it goes up. And then you'll see there in the beginning of May, it's at a number. And then it drops a lot more after that. And that's around that time that I believe.
I think around May is where they announced the deal was done.
I remember it very well.
And then they had to have an emergency conference call.
They didn't even have a conference call kind of planned. And that was kind of funny that they had to do that at the last second. But it was, you could see it was a big learning for them since then. You can see that first quarter there, you know, that first quarter right there, there was a ton of speculation, a ton of money, and nobody had good numbers. You know, everybody, you know, they thought they were going to walk out of the gate with a million. And they came in at 667, 298, or whatever the number was. And that was a big shock. And at the same time, the big shock was that they still had tons and tons of people who bought WrestleMania on traditional pay-per-view, kind of just proving that maybe they might have overshot the mark a little bit for where they went on a lot of things.
This would have been a great time to buy, right? Like the share price of this company has doubled since that point.
Yeah, but I think that's a long-term investment to only double your share price from mid-2014 till now. You know, I think there's a lot of other stocks out there that you could have invested in and done a lot better with. I would say it wasn't a bad investment, but I don't think it necessarily had a huge ROI on it. Let's talk a little bit about going back to that slide there about the different timing for the deals. One scenario, which is intriguing, what if they announce, okay, it's May of 2018 and they announce they're not going to NBCU? Well, their deal with NBCU lasts until September 30th of 2019, but they could announce as early as May 2018, hey, I'm not staying with you. My gut feeling is unless they're going to stay with NBCU, they're going to draw that out as much as they can. They're not going to start that. They're not going to give themselves a year and a half of thrashing on a partner that doesn't want to be with them.
And I think it was Brandon Ross or someone who asked Berrios if there were any other partners, what they think about that. I think Berrios said it's a small core cohort of networks that would be interested in WWE.
And in no way did they imply that Facebook or Netflix or Amazon were those players. And that's what's funny to me is that you see those names so much with analysts and you rarely see those names actually showing up on WWE shortlist. And I think they would say, oh, we're open to anyone, yada, yada, yada. But I think they also recognize that live sports streaming, digital platforming is probably not in the wheelhouse of someone like Netflix and is an abstraction for someone like Amazon and is a risk for someone like Facebook and is probably just not where they're going to go. I think they're going to stay on a traditional TV player. And in fact, they said, we think the bundle is going to exist in 2019. We think pay TV is still where it's at. And if anything, I felt like they kind of lowered their rhetoric from maybe where they were 6 months or 9 months ago in a recognition that they had to be more realistic about who their options were on the table. They refused to say whether or not there was an exclusive period for NBCU. I think there is an exclusive period for NBCU where they can't.
By exclusive period, they mean a time where WWE is only going to negotiate with NBCU and not with other.
And possibly NBCU might even have like right of first refusal or something, you know, basically the right to say, we'll match that deal. You have to come back to us with any deal that you get from somebody else.
Okay.
Something like that. I'm not sure they, you know, of course those details aren't super, super explicit, but you have to also remember WWE launched the network right before they announced their deal in such a way that even some of the heads of these networks felt they were caught off guard by WWE Network launching their network, that they felt cheated and tricked by them. Because they killed, of course, a bunch of pay-per-view business for them. And so we're in a much better place and a much better relationship than we were on the last rotation cycle here. WWE does nothing but brag about how much NBCU has found new sponsors for them, more than 70 this year, how they have blue chip sponsors. They mentioned, you know, pharmaceuticals and cars and insurance and people. They used to say the only people that wanted to advertise with us was theatrical releases and gaming companies. Now we have all these other actual companies like Kraft that want to be on us. And they refused to say whether they.
And you think all that work makes it more likely that they're going to stay with NBCU?
I think what happened is they had to give up their revenue share model, right? They had to give up their advertising model where they took any of that money, either selling it themselves or by like sharing in that. Well, what does that mean? That means you have to make sure that the person you're working for is happy. And at this point, it would seem foolish for them to blow away the, let's see, they went back, was it 2012? What year did they re-sign with? No, it was like 2008, wasn't it? That they like re-signed with, NBCU when they went back to USA. Actually, might have even been 2005. What year did the Viacom deal end is what I'm trying to get at here. Just figure out what channel Raw was on and then when it switched back to USA. That's really what my question is.
And, returns USA Network 2005, yeah.
2005, okay. So since 2005, they've been on the USA Network. And since then, they've consolidated more and more programming. So at this point, they're going to have a good 14 years of history with them. They've always had a close relationship with NBC Universal, or at least with USA Network. And as long as Bonnie Hammer's been really involved, and she, I believe, is still the head of like Universal programming, she's been big. The one time they left the network was when she got kind of knocked out of power and she was doing something else. That was when they went to Viacom. So I just don't see them leaving NBCU at this time. Now, they might shake up what they're doing in UK or India or these other marketplaces. They even hinted that they might bundle their digital rights and their TV rights differently in other places. But I just don't see them. I just don't see them blowing up this NBCU deal unless they get such a killer deal from an ESPN Disney type conglomerate where it's going on the ESPN app in some way. Or if it's a crazy Fox deal where Fox is just pouring money into them to try to revitalize the fact that they've lost UFC.
Yeah. And if this is going to happen this early, I doubt that it's going to happen, right? Like, I think one of the things you said is that, well, it would be more appealing for ESPN to get WWE if ESPN had an OTT service to better utilize WWE with, right?
And they will by 2019.
Yeah, I but they're gonna. Do you make a deal in this time frame, though?
You
know what I'm saying?
People have always said to me that you want to have these deals done more than a year out, and you're negotiating, 2 years out. So I'm not surprised. Okay. I think just for them, though, they want to make sure that they have a lot of more continuity of what exactly they're doing. And the last piece is they're talking Raw and SmackDown here. They are not including, Total Divas, Total Bellas, the Ms. Marie show, reality shows, anything else that they're programming. That isn't necessarily being bundled with this. And in fact, I would have a hard time believing that those would leave the E! Network if they're still going on in that year, because I think the producers and the other people putting the money into it, I don't know if they could move. That said, hey, Project Runway and some of these other big, platform shows for networks have moved channels before. So it's not to say it's impossible. But that's the other element.
It's separate contracts for Raw and SmackDown versus Total Divas, Total Bellas.
Yeah, if you notice, they never mentioned those other properties. They were really specific that they were talking about Raw and SmackDown when they talked about the negotiations they were doing at that time.
Yeah. So it's possible that Raw and SmackDown could move off of the USA Network, but Total Divas and Total Bellas could stay on the E! Network.
Or even would they maybe SmackDown? I mean, if I was WWE, what I would love to do would be move my SmackDown to another network and use that as a leverage point. Leave Raw on USA on Monday nights. That's a commodity. That's a given. That's a programming history.
Yeah, it's been there
but
forever.
SmackDown, more often than not, anyway. Why not use that to prop up a Fox Sports or something like that and then have the options to be able to be, leveraged on another network the way they were years and years ago when it was back on,
UPN or
exactly. And I think it reaches a slightly different group of people. And then you have a chance for more eyeballs. And the fact is they've been willing to play ball with ESPN, even though ESPN is not an NBC Universal company. So it's not to say that they're not willing to sometimes do cross promotion and cross branding if it's in their benefit. So I could definitely see them not necessarily bundling Raw and SmackDown together in the future. Now it limits them and it puts you at some risk, but I honestly, if I was them, that's what I'd be looking for most with my WWE renewal. Because the other thing that does is it creates, it's a lot harder to compare the deals if it's on two networks than if it's all bundled in one. And so it makes it harder for the financial analyst to look at the deal and say whether it was good or bad. Because otherwise, there's the argument, would NBCU want to pay less if there was only a 2-hour show for Raw every week? And, you know, what would be the value to that? And so if you're doing all those kind of trades and you move them at once, it's really hard sometimes to do all the math to figure out whether you're happy or sad with that deal.
Yeah.
So that I think is one of the big takeaways from what's happening right now, is just that they obviously have a lot of negotiations to do and they have a lot of announcing to do. And so we're going to see the fervor in Q2, Q3, Q4, and Q1 of the next year just be tons of these TV deals, kind of pressure on them to make some announcements. And maybe we're going to go back to seeing the days of crazy affinity charts of 159 million people want to be on WWE. Or
so we haven't seen so the investor presentation that we're looking at here is different from the presentations we've seen at other times, like when George Berrios does a talk or something, right? We haven't seen one of those in a while.
Yeah, they disappeared. They basically stopped. They stopped doing different versions. And now they just started using the earnings slides. On top of that, they would only update the investor presentation whenever George was actually going out and doing investor conferences. He does most of his investor conferences during Q1 and a little bit in Q2. There's almost none in Q3. And then there's a couple in Q4 because he always does like a UBS Future of Media or a Morgan Stanley one in like October, November, December that he seems to always be talking at. But for the most part, what's that?
We should be due for that then, right?
Well, oh, yeah, actually, you're right. I would have to, you know, the easiest place to find is if you go to indeedwrestling.blogspot.com or wrestlenomics.com, you can find the transcripts of the notes I put up about some of the older calls. And usually then you can look at the date of when those were. But you're right. I think it was December. There's definitely one that he's gone to. And maybe there's one in November, too, that he's done. Because I remember the lead up to WWE Network, he did a whole bunch of conferences. And I was always listening into them and finding little nuggets. Mm-hmm. All right.
Anything else? We got to let you go pretty soon. You got to be on Wrestling Observer Live.
Oh my gosh, do I?
Right.
I think I might.
5-2. Yeah, you got like 5 minutes.
I might. I probably have a text from them right now, being like, "Hey, what's your phone number? We need to call you."
Probably do.
All right. Okay. Well, I want to say thank you, everybody, for listening to WrestleNomics Radio and trying this new experiment with us. We're going to have to talk on another show about the Cloud9 funding, about the New Japan travel packages, about Linda McMahon talking at a Trump hotel and Nia Jax walking off. There's a lot of other stories we could be telling right now. But I want to say thank you for everyone for tuning in and watching this initial broadcast. And we'll have to see how much of it is salvageable as an audio.
Probably not much of it. But we've at least done this.
Yes.
You know, do plugs real quick. There's an article that I wrote for Fightful.com this morning, just running down the results, which is a lot of stuff that we talked about here, but in maybe in more detail. We got some charts and graphs in there, and it looks like I have through some sort of proxy, there's a second article on Fightful, which includes just a ton of my tweets. Looks like Sean Ross Savage has just done a big tweet dump of me and made it an article. So there you have it. You can check out, go to Fightful.com and check that out.
And you can find me on Twitter at Mookie Gatta, and I did a whole bunch of tweeting myself this morning all about this stuff. And I will be on Wrestling Observer Live in just a few moments here, apparently. Forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me.
Did you forget?
A little bit.
I've been watching the clock, and you're like, okay, we got until 3 o'clock here.
That makes more sense. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon. Check us out on patreon.com/WrestleNomics. Bye-bye.